To Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
one of the fascinating things was after its bad losing streak in the 1950s, as the Democratic Party tried to reconstitute and you know establish itself going into the 60s with the dynamic leadership of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson as his running mate, their 1960 platform recommitted to the Economic Bill of Rights. It actually was written into the platform.
Part two of our modern history of the Democratic Party. Today we focus on FDR's Economic Bill of Rights that didn't actually die with FDR, but continue all the way up to today to be a part of the great debate within the party. We'll talk about this history with John Nichols, author of the book The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Former President Barack Obama is set to deliver a eulogy at the Atlanta funeral of Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis, which is underway. Former Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton have also eulogized Lewis. President Trump is not attending. Ebenezer Baptist Church pastor Raphael Warnock recalled that as a teen, John Lewis had considered joining the ministry.
But as his life took shape, instead of preaching sermons, he became one. He became a living, walking sermon about truth-telling and justice-making in the earth. He loved America until America learned how to love him back. We celebrate John Lewis.
In an essay he asked to be published in the New York Times on the day of his funeral, John Lewis urged others to continue to seek justice. He wrote, "Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring." One-time Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain has died more than a month after attending President Trump's indoor Tulsa, Oklahoma rally without wearing a mask. Cain was 74 years old and was hospitalized within 2 weeks of attending the Trump rally, although it's not certain where he contracted the virus. He was a co-chair of Black Voices for Trump. A double whammy of bad economic news as the coronavirus pandemic continues to take a deadly toll. More than 2.2 million people applied for jobless benefits last week under two separate programs. 1.4 million applied for traditional unemployment benefits. An additional 830,000 applied for jobless aid under a new program that extends eligibility for the first time to self-employed and gig workers. In another gauge of the plunging economy, the Commerce Department reported the economy shrank at a dizzying 33% annual rate in the April through June quarter, by far the worst quarterly plunge ever. Speaking on KPFA's Upfront, Economic Policy Institute senior economist Elise Gould called the statistic incredibly significant, although not unexpected.
It is just enormous, 32.9% at an annualized rate in the second quarter, after a contraction in the first quarter of 5%. This is big news. Unfortunately, other indicators are telling us that there's going to be more bad news to come.
The situation is about to get worse. A supplemental $600 in weekly federal unemployment benefits that has helped keep unemployed people afloat is expiring. While congressional Democrats want to extend it, Republicans say they won't agree to the full $600 amount. Oregon Senate Democrat Ron Wyden said canceling the $600 additional weekly benefit will cause an economic collapse.
So what you have with today's analysis is a gross domestic product in free fall. If Republicans slash unemployment benefits with this proposal, the gross domestic product is going to fall faster and the economy collapses.
There's deep division within the ranks of Senate Republicans over a new coronavirus relief bill. Democrats will today dramatize their support for the House $3 trillion relief bill by attempting to put it up for a vote in the Senate. President Trump is floating the idea of delaying the presidential election as he faces dimming electoral prospects in the light of the economic freefall and the pandemic, which has claimed more than 150,000 U.S. lives. On Twitter this morning, Trump says without evidence that mail-in voting will result in 2020 being the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. Then he suggests delaying the election until people can, quote, properly, securely, and safely vote. Trump has no authority to delay the election, whose date is set by Congress. The Constitution makes no provision for delaying a presidential inauguration. Speaking to CNN this morning, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin pushed back against the idea of an election delay.
It's never been done, Jim, and it never should be done. There is no reason for us, unless you're buying into a conspiracy theory, unless you're trying to set a scenario up if, in case the election doesn't go the way the president wants it to go or thinks it should go in his favor, setting it up that something is awry. Well, let me tell you, there's an awful lot of Republican Secretary of States, a lot of Republican senators and congresspeople who have been doing mail-in ballots for a long, long time and feel very secured in doing it. So this is not a justification why we should not have an election or delay election.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. The U.S. Supreme Court says Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has undergone a non-surgical medical procedure in New York City and expects to be released from a hospital by the end of the week. The court said the 87-year-old justice underwent a minimally invasive procedure to revise a bile duct stent. The stent had originally been placed last August when Ginsburg was treated for a cancerous tumor on her pancreas. Ginsburg announced earlier this month she's receiving chemotherapy for a recurrence of cancer. A federal appeals court said it plans to review a decision ordering the dismissal of the Justice Department's case against former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. The action by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia is likely to prolong the fight over Flynn's fate. It represents yet another dramatic development in a case that has taken unexpected twists and turns over the last year. The court set arguments for August 11th. It did not offer an explanation for its decision in a brief order posted online. A three-judge panel of the court had ruled 2-1 last month that federal district judge Emmett Sullivan had overstepped his bounds by not granting Attorney General Bill Barr's request to dismiss the case against Flynn. Flynn had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russian ambassador during the presidential transition period. When the three-judge panel ruled against Sullivan, the judge asked the full court to review that decision. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we bring you part two of a two-part series that we are doing on the modern history of the Democratic Party. Before we got into the rise and fall of Henry Wallace, perhaps this country's most progressive vice president in history, who was removed from that position by the Democratic Party when it became clear that Franklin D. Roosevelt did not have long to live. Our guest is John Nichols of The Nation magazine. John Nichols is the author of the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John Nichols, thank you for coming back.
I am honored to be with you, of course. What a pleasure to talk to you about all this.
Last time, again, we largely focused on the rise and fall of Henry Wallace and how he was removed from that position at the Democratic Convention in 1944 as the vice presidential candidate in that election when it became clear by the party that FDR probably didn't have long to live, which he didn't because he would die less than a year later. Of course, Henry Wallace was replaced by Harry Truman. You make this argument. I want to pick up where we left off. This started a power struggle dynamic within the party that we've had ever since.
There's simply no question of that. And I wouldn't necessarily say, the only clarification I might make on it is that I'm not sure it started there. I think it actually existed before, but this is where it got clarity. and you had a strong sense that while Roosevelt had changed the Democratic Party dramatically, and in fact had made it a very, very different party than the one he inherited in 1932 as its nominee, he had not succeeded in embedding into the party or building into the party an activist sensibility, and one that would carry forward the energy and the determination of the New Deal. And that's the big deal here, because that's what Wallace was arguing for. He was saying that the New Deal didn't go far enough. There was a lot more that had to be done after World War II, and that Democrats needed to be a fighting, he used the word liberal, we would use the word progressive, but that it needed to be a fighting liberal party going forward, committed to economic and social and racial justice, committed to implementing Roosevelt's vision of an economic bill of rights, i.e. guaranteeing access to health care, housing, transportation, jobs, and frankly, that it would seek on the global stage to dial down tensions with other countries, to find ways to negotiate rather than fight new wars. Not that Wallace was a pacifist. He was not. He was more than willing to fight necessary wars, but he was very conscious of the threat that that Eisenhower, who was an associate of Wallace's as well, that Eisenhower would eventually characterize as the military-industrial complex and all of the complexities that came with that. So it was 44 where you really had all of this come to a head, and Wallace was rejected. And in fact, not much later than that, even though he remained in the administration as Secretary of Commerce under Roosevelt and then under Truman, Wallace was ostracized, pushed out of the administration, as were other New Dealers. And the Democratic Party set itself on a course toward a willingness to compromise and a willingness to concede rather than a determination to be a fighting party.
I wanted to ask you about the timing that you look at in this book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Early on in your introduction, even, you call it a book on the history of party politics. And you begin, I mean, really, this begins with the New Deal era. The Democratic Party obviously has been around much longer than that, but it's the New Deal era that represents, well, you said clarity earlier. I guess I was going to ask if it represented a shift.
You're right that it is a shift, but remember, Roosevelt was still around, and that's an important part of all this, because Franklin Roosevelt, you know, did in fact run the 44 election, and in fact Henry Wallace, who we talk about a lot, campaigned aggressively in the 44 election, and there's simply no question that in many ways the Roosevelt-Wallace team carried forward, even though Truman was the vice presidential nominee. Roosevelt and Wallace remained in close contact. And in writing the book, I went through a lot of their communications during the fall of 1944. And it was clear that the two of them were formulating a vision for where to go in the post-war era. And that vision was, in many ways, focused on a renewal of the New Deal. Wallace wrote about it in a book on, you know, creating millions of jobs in the post-war era. And Roosevelt actually talked about it in some of his greatest final speeches. So even though there was a shift at the party level, i.e. the party had chosen a much more cautious, much more centrist vice presidential running mate for Roosevelt. Had Roosevelt lived, I think you would have continued to see an energetic and New Deal focused Democratic Party going forward. So the shift really occurred at the party level or at the structural level at the convention. But in a practical sense, I would argue it occurred when Roosevelt died.
Is this a period of time, John, in which there is, and I'm not thinking just late or middle 1940s or even early 1940s, but I'm thinking throughout the entire deal, that getting back to this shift of the Democratic Party, is it anything like what we're witnessing today? And I don't mean to say that they're still not very powerful centrists in the Democratic Party today, but I think over the last 4 years, we have seen a shift to the left. Is there any comparison to like what, you know, we've all been able to witness what's happening now to what was happening in the 1930s and 40s to the party?
Sure. There's 100% comparison. It's a very significant one. Obviously, the times are different, the players are different, the circumstances are different. But what you saw in the period from 1940 to 1944, especially, was a real move to the left by the Democratic Party. And that clearly was related to Wallace. Roosevelt brought Wallace in with an eye toward moving the party to the left, toward basically forging a new coalition that was less reliant on cautious, more centrist Democrats, less reliant on the Southern segregationists, and on, you know, frankly, the money power, and more reliant on building out a populist, progressive populist base. Roosevelt felt, and he talked about this is no secret, that it was going to be necessary to do this as the country moved into World War II. Wallace believed this very, very strongly. There needed to be sort of a strong, unified vision for why the war would be fought. Remember, there had been a lot of opposition to the war. There was isolationism domestically, and for what the purposes of that war would be. Roosevelt outlined it with the Four Freedoms, and then in the midst of the war, ramped up that message again and again in speeches that I recount in the book, and finally with the Economic Bill of Rights, which was a vision for how to complete the war fight and then come out of it domestically and frankly also with a sense of how the country would relate to the rest of the world. And so that was clearly a time when the party was moving to the left. And then in 1944 and 1945, there was a clear effort by party bosses, by, again, the Southern segregationists, by the money power, to move it back into a more cautious stance.
Because they never left the party. They were still there.
Oh, very much. In fact, that's why the book is titled The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. They felt they were in a fight.
So interesting to me that the party, the Democratic Party, and again, this is the governing party during the war years, that it's during these war years that it moved to the left.
Yeah. Well, but you see, this is the interesting thing. Our conservative friends will tell us that the New Deal was not successful. And they'll say that the only thing that really got the United States out of the Depression was World War II. And you've heard, and that's a casual reference to an analysis that sometimes conservatives will put forward. But what they fail to recognize is, of course, that in World War II, you had the New Deal on steroids. You had the government, being much more aggressive as regards planning and programs and structures. And, you really had the outlining, if you will, of many of the models for a planned economy and for a social welfare state related to that. And this wasn't just in the United States. You saw the same things happening in Great Britain. Remember that Winston Churchill, who we talk about a lot and who comes up a lot in this book, he was the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and we focus so much on him. But what we lose sight of the fact is that he led a coalition that included the left. And in fact, when Churchill came to power in Britain, they ostracized the isolationist or collaborationist or concessionist Tories, right? The conservatives who were, who had sought to appease the Nazis in the pre-war era. They were isolated and discredited. And you really had, in the United Kingdom during World War II, a very planned, very structured economy, as you had to. And you also had the development of outlines for a social welfare state with the Beveridge Report and other studies that came forward. So this was a global reality. And the Democratic Party was unquestionably in this period moving toward a much more left-wing stance.
Previously, we got into how Henry Wallace was removed as vice president at the 1944 Democratic National Convention. And I don't want to go through all of that again, but it is interesting to think of what would happen over the next few years, especially after the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt. What would happen to Wallace, as though he was marginalized within the party? And I wanted to ask, how significant was the onset of the Cold War to that?
Well, Wallace sought to avert the Cold War, or at least to temper its reality. And he believed that that was possible. He was not alone in believing that that was possible. There was a great debate in the period of 1946, 47, 48 there, and even beyond. Of course it was significant. There's no question that you saw developments in Europe and other places around the world that alarmed folks. Joseph Stalin, the Soviet leader, was an aggressive in his post-war actions. And there was, you know, there was no question that the United States and the Soviet Union were getting into position for a Cold War. Wallace felt that at the very least that could be tempered, that could be constrained, and that ultimately there didn't have to be another war. You might have to, you might have to take significant steps to deal with challenges and threats around the world, but that you also ought to emphasize diplomacy, a fight for the, the moral high ground, and frankly, a whole bunch of practical steps, which he outlined in speeches and talked about. But there's no doubt that the United States in the late 1940s was on a trajectory toward a Cold War, and that Cold War played out internationally and domestically, as obviously with the Red Scare. So there's no question that had a huge impact, because Wallace's arguments lost. They lost within the Truman administration, and he was forced out of the Truman administration. They lost politically in 1948 when he ran an independent campaign for the presidency, seeking to reassert many of the New Deal ideas, but also promoting the idea of peace. And in the aftermath of that 1948 campaign, you really saw a situation where the Democratic Party really scrambled over toward many of its more conservative instincts. In 1952, the Democratic nominee for vice president was a Southern segregationist who had opposed Truman's reelection in 1948. So you really saw Truman himself and many of the other leaders of the party abandoning the vision that Roosevelt had put forward and that others had hoped to see play out.
From 1952 to 1960, the president is Dwight D. Eisenhower, a Republican. Democrats are still prominent in Congress. What does the 1950s represent for progressive politics within the Democratic Party? Is this a period of time when they're, in the wilderness, or what is it?
Well, they were ostracized. Many progressives were ostracized. Remember, the interesting thing was that, while the segregationists who left the party in 48 to run a states' rights party campaign led by Strom Thurmond were invited back in, the Democrats, and there were Democrats who backed Henry Wallace, were not generally invited back in. In fact, they were really seen as folks who were not welcome. Wallace himself was not welcome. And there was a little bit of an effort in 1952 to maintain the Progressive Party line that Wallace had run on, but it collapsed. It was not successful. You had the Red Scare going on, very aggressively, going after people in unions, people in civil rights groups, others. So you saw it's sort of a movement toward a much more centrist position. Now, I think it's important to understand that there's always a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. And so in the 1950s, you saw a regrouping with a lot of younger folks stepping up, many of them veterans of World War II, who were aggressively saying that the party needed to be better, on civil rights, on economic justice, on a host of issues, and frankly, that the party needed to explore foreign policies that were much more related to Eisenhower's concerns about military-industrial complex, and frankly, Eisenhower's concerns about what he referred to as the cross of iron, which was massive military spending to the extent that it might undermine domestic programs and domestic spending. And so you saw Democrats who really wanted to fill that space, but through much of the 50s, they were not very successful. The Democratic nominee for president, Adlai Stevenson, was a relatively liberal guy, but he very much made the concession that others in the party had and did, which was to the South, the so-called Solid South. And what that meant was that Democrats were far more cautious on the essential issues of the moment, civil rights and labor rights and another host of other issues, than they should have been. They ran campaigns that were often convoluted and dysfunctional. At the same time, the Republicans, amazingly enough, and I write a lot about this in the book, it was fascinating. The Republicans saw the vulnerability and they actually moved into the space. In 1956, when Eisenhower ran for re-election, there was a major effort by President Eisenhower and the Republicans to reach out to the African-American community, which was a growing voting bloc in the country. And Adam Clayton Powell, the most prominent African-American elected official in the country at that point, a Democratic member of Congress from New York, split with the Democratic Party and actively campaigned for Eisenhower. Henry Wallace as well, the former Democratic vice president, endorsed Eisenhower. And you saw a number of Democrats around the country who were unsatisfied with their ability to move their own party and literally supported the Republican president for re-election. Eisenhower got a landslide victory in 1956, and he did indeed increase the African-American vote for the Democratic Party substantially. And you really saw a moment there in 57 with the very limited but still important civil rights bill that went through Congress, with Eisenhower's court appointments and other steps that did in fact move the country in significant ways. And then at the same time, you saw the rise, much more important in many ways, of the modern civil rights movement as a very focused, very increasingly aggressive movement. Ultimately, the Democrats began, I think, at the higher levels to recognize this. And you did see in 1960, early 60s, some significant movement there. But the 50s were really, in so many ways, for the Democratic Party, a lost decade. And it was a decade where the party was so cautious, so compromised, that they actually gave the Republican Party a tremendous amount of space in which to challenge the Democrats for basic voting blocks. I would remind you of one other thing, too, that in 1956, the Republican Party ran an aggressive campaign in which they emphasized how pro-labor they were, how pro-union they were. Now, that may seem unimaginable today, but that was what happened. And it was, in many ways, sort of a last gasp of the sort of bipartisan consensus as regards labor rights.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with John Nichols. John Nichols is the author of the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. And we are in conversation about the modern history of the Democratic Party. So the Southern segregationists are obviously, within the Democratic Party, are obviously an important part of this story. What's significant about 1960 and the party starting to shift on some of these issues around civil rights? Because if I recall correctly, the party actually adopted support for the civil rights all the way back in 1948 at that convention then.
Even in 44, their platform began to talk about these issues. 48, of course, under pressure, I think it's fair to say, from A. Philip Randolph, the civil rights movement of that time, as well as from Wallace's third party candidacy, the party did move toward a more robust embrace of civil rights messages. And Hubert Humphrey gets credit for this because he delivered an epic speech at the 1948 convention in which he talked about, you know, moving, you know, into the sunshine of civil rights. It was very, very important. But the party still, you know, kind of whipsawed back and forth on this issue. And even though it would sometimes have good language on civil rights and individuals would have some good language at the higher levels, you had the situation where they deferred to the South. And it was sort of summed up by a Republican message in 1956, which was, if you vote Democratic, right, if you vote for Democrats for the presidency and for the Senate, you are voting to empower segregationists who will chair the key committees of the Congress. And that was right. In fact, that well through the 50s, into the 60s, into the 70s, you had people who had been or who were and later who had been active segregationists, people who signed the Southern Manifesto, which was a statement signed overwhelmingly by Southern Democratic members of the House and Senate. In which they said they would fight at every turn against civil rights legislation, and that was in the mid 50s. This is the sort of awful compromise that occurred. Even as the party began to speak in better terms about civil rights and frankly about economic and social justice on many levels, you still had some of the most powerful figures in the party, especially in the U.S. Senate, folks from Mississippi and Alabama and the Carolinas and Georgia, running committees and effectively defining a huge amount of legislation. And the party's position, the party's flexibility, it took one of their own, in a sense, although he was a better player. Lyndon Johnson, who became president at the death of John Kennedy in 1963, to break this hold, if you will. And here's the interesting thing about Johnson in 1964 and 1965, when he was advancing the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, he relied on high levels of support from Republicans. And those were bipartisan bills. And the opposition to those bills, proportionally a huge part of the opposition to those bills, came from Southern Democrats, still members of the Democratic Party. And those forces continued to fight for the soul of the Democratic Party in that period. There were real battles. And I would emphasize to you that, you know, one of the Southern Democrats, George Wallace, ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1964. Wallace split from the party in 68 and ran an independent candidacy. He came back and ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in the 70s. In 72, he ran a very, very strong campaign. And so this division, this fight over where the Democratic Party would go was ongoing. It was real. It wasn't just about segregation and then in later years about discrimination and about the extent to which you would accept the progress of the 60s. It was also about a host of labor and economic issues and war and peace issues. I mean, the battles within the Democratic Party over Vietnam, which I write a lot about, were very real. And you had a right and a left within the Democratic Party.
The years of the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson is interesting and I imagine quite important in the story that you are telling. I want to spend some time on that. Let's begin with Johnson's push for the Great Society. Is this in line with the New Deal?
Yeah. I mean, Johnson was a New Dealer. Imperfect, flawed, like most New Dealers were, and he was also a very crass, very aggressive politician and political power broker. But there's simply no question that Johnson wanted to renew many of the ideals of and much of the energy of the New Deal, which had been. If you think about the death of Roosevelt in 45 up until when Johnson became president, with a little bit of variation from Kennedy there, the New Deal was being locked in. It was maintained in many senses, but the extension of it, the expansion of it, which had been a constant characteristic of the New Deal in the 1930s and 1940s, particularly the 30s, wasn't there. And Johnson hoped to go big, to be an epic president and to do huge things. And so, yes, he moved on civil rights, and he moved on a host of other issues. You did have this vision of a great society. If you look at Johnson's speeches in that era, they were epic. And they were formed in many cases by and advised by his close advisor, Bill Moyers, who many people know to this day, also by John Gardner and others who were very, very progressive folks within his administration, his own vice president.
I want to follow up on Bill Moyers there, just because I always knew him as Johnson's press secretary, but he was more than that.
Oh, much more. If you read the diaries and the reports on that time, and I did a lot for this book, Bill Moyers was an incredibly influential figure in the Johnson White House. They were both Texans, and that was perhaps a factor there. But also, Johnson liked where Moyers was at, and he liked where John Gardner was at and where some of these other folks were at. There was a vision for an activist administration, this idea of, recreating, in a sense, the New Deal, or at least a New Deal vision. And so it's also important to, and as we've talked about before, I think it's important to understand the movements that were in play at the time as well. The 1963 March on Washington was March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And A. Philip Randolph, key organizer there with Martin Luther King Jr., Eric Rustin, and others, their vision was for civil rights, unquestionably, but also for economic rights. And they wrote a freedom budget, which was presented to the White House, and which Johnson took relatively seriously, at least entertained, talking about, healthcare for all, housing for all, transportation, education, and fundamental shifts that really was, in many ways, I guess, best understood as getting serious about Roosevelt's 1944 Economic Bill of Rights, making that, bringing that forward and bringing it into the discourse of the 1960s. Those movements were pressuring the White House. Johnson was, in many ways, responsive to those movements, not always, but often. And there, but for the Vietnam War, I think there is a very real, in fact, I would say this aggressively, there is a real sense that Lyndon Johnson's presidency might well have been a renewal of the New Deal.
That's interesting. The Economic Bill of Rights. Tell me more about that. It's oftentimes called the Second Bill of Rights. And I guess it's interesting to me because whenever I do hear about FDR's Second Bill of Rights, I think of it basically dying with him. But what you're saying is it was very much alive some two decades later.
Absolutely. 100%. In fact, this is a fascinating thing. I've just been recently writing about the Democratic platform fights. And wow. I went back and read through Democratic platforms, and one of the fascinating things was after its bad losing streak in the 1950s, as the Democratic Party tried to reconstitute and establish itself going into the 60s with the dynamic leadership of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson as his running mate, their 1960 platform recommitted to the Economic Bill of Rights. It actually was written into the platform. And they said, we want to get back to this. A. Philip Randolph and others, who, again, we come to often in this story, never forgot the Economic Bill of Rights. And they, when they were talking about the freedom budget and other proposals, it would reference it and would, bow to or defer to it as a baseline. It wasn't necessarily the only thing they were talking about, but it was something they understood. And I think, Mitch, one of the things to recognize here is that history and time sometimes makes us lose perspective. Today, talking about 1944 seems so far ago, so far in the past. Even talking about the 60s seems like a very long time ago. But in 1964, to give you an example, the Economic Bill of Rights was only 20 years old. It was only 20 years earlier. And there were lots of people who remembered Franklin Roosevelt. There were people in politics who had served with Franklin Roosevelt. And so there were economists who had been around the Roosevelt White House and were still influential. I will give you one name just as a reference point. John Kenneth Galbraith, who had been in the New Deal administration and was a very significant economic figure, leader, advisor, counselor, author in the 1960s. In fact, Galbraith was probably at the peak of his influence in the 60s and 70s. And he was certainly somebody who understood the Economic Bill of Rights and talked about it.
I keep thinking about FDR's Second Bill of Rights or the Economic Bill of Rights. And again, this idea that I think is commonly presented as something that died with the death of FDR, but yet there it was in the push for, quote unquote, the Great Society in the 1960s. I imagine it was there with the presidential run of George McGovern in 1972. Perhaps it was there with the presidential run of Jesse Jackson in 1988. And perhaps it's there not only in the run from Bernie Sanders in 2016, but even now in the fight over the Democratic platform.
Unquestionably. In fact, it's funny that you mentioned that, because in writing the book, I traveled a lot. I went, because I believe in when you write about history, you have to go to the places where it occurred. If only to stand there and try and take something in, it can be an intangible, but I think it's relevant. And so I went to Henry Wallace's birthplace in Iowa, the home where he grew up, repeatedly. And on one of those trips, just about a year ago now, a little bit less than a year ago now, I went there with Bernie Sanders. And we stood in the upstairs room of a barn that's off the house, where they have a little, and I really want to emphasize, a little museum to Henry Wallace's legacy and history. It's got old pictures of Roosevelt and Wallace and some magazine covers and things of that nature, a few relics and mementos. And we were alone in the room, just standing there talking. I was interviewing him. And Sanders spoke at great length about the Economic Bill of Rights. He came back to it again and again and again. He made it very central to his message in 2016 and 2020. And it's, I think it's notable that 75 years after Roosevelt brought the Economic Bill of Rights out, and after Henry Wallace sought to make it a framework for the Democratic Party going forward, Bernie Sanders popularized the idea with a new generation of Democrats. I think there are probably more people talking about the Economic Bill of Rights now than there were in the period from the 60s to the early 2000s. And it's notable that many of the ideas underpinned or outlined in the Economic Bill of Rights, healthcare as a right, education as a right, jobs as a right, are issues that the Democratic Party continues to wrestle with right now.
John Nichols, thank you.
It's a tremendous honor to talk to you about all this. It's as you can see, I enjoy discussing it.
I mean, we could really do part three, but we're on a time limit here. John Nichols is the author of The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics.